This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
On the 22nd of October 2013, our guest was Professor Jesper Jespersen, who presented his paper on Keynes and exchange rate systems, and our main discussant was Professor Jeff Harcourt. Jesper Jespersen is Professor of Economics at the Department of Society and Globalization at the University of Roskilde in Denmark. Jeff Harcourt is Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Adelaide and Emeritus Fellow of Jesus College, Cambridge.
It's always difficult to speak to such a distinguished audience, but I will try, mainly stick to my paper, so I'm sure that it is rather precisely what I intended to say, but also because, this is, for me, a rather formal lecture. At home, I would speak more freely and just taking departure from the PowerPoints and then develop the lecture from that. But here, I will be more bound to my manuscript. But the idea is to combine, the thinking and the development of the thinking of Keynes on exchange rate system, combine it with the actual situation in Europe and see what we can learn and what we should learn from the writings of Keynes. But, of course, it is pretentious of me to use, the writing of Keynes, because, as you know, his collected writings run to 30 volumes. So I had to make a shortcut. And there, for his thinking in the 20s on the exchange rate, I made a shortcut. It is because, I could take advantage of Keynes selecting some of his writings on his own in the volume 9 called Essays in Persuasion. There is a section there where he had, selected seven papers from his writings in the 20s and said, this is what I want to, put into this volume on the gold standard and, what could come after. And these papers I will refer to in the first part of my lecture. And then, there's an interlude because, as we all know, Keynes, in some theoretical sense, changed his mind from the 20s to the 30s. His thinking on macroeconomics, theory and method changed, to a large extent. How dramatic the change was, is disputed by Keynes scholars, but I think it was rather substantial, and that explains why he put forward for the Bretton Woods Conference in 1944 a very different proposal on how to organize the international currency system after the Second World War, which is very different from, the organization after the First World War. So that will bring us the way forward to the actual situation in Europe. And one would say maybe bring us backward, because we will start with the gold exchange standard, or just the prelude to the gold standard. And many people would say that what we are experiencing right now in continental Europe is something similar to the gold standard. So what have we learned? But anyway, any theoretical discussion has to be judged on the historical premises, the context, and the intention. And now I'm back in the 20s and try to figure out, Keynes' thought in that period. And Keynes had the ambition of making an impact on British economic policy to make society more human. And he had a dream of economists taking the back seat already at that time and let love, beauty and truth being the steering principles. But just after the First World War, realities were quite different from that, well, dream society. Hence, the dominant dream by politicians and society with respect to economic matters was a return to the pre-war situation with price stability and relative high employment. The dramatic price increases just during and immediately after the war was considered in the UK, but also in the US, as an exception. So was the suspension of the convertibility of the paper money into gold. Exceptions from what should be normal practice. But Keynes, in his book, A Tract on Monetary Reform from 22, well, he diagnoses two different adjustment problems, even related to this debate on price stability versus exchange rate stability, because one, he said already in 22, we have to choose between either internal price stability, monetary policy used for internal price stability, or we could fix the exchange rate, the currency to the to a certain gold exchange rate, but that would mean that monetary policy should be directed towards balance of payments and, in fact, the stock of gold directly, and to a lesser extent to the internal price adjustment. And these two adjustment processes has a different speed. So if we choose one, we have to give up the other. And Keynes's preference was absolutely at that time in favor of stable prices and taking care of during monetary policy. So in his perception, that was, well, monetary policy was for stabilizing prices. And there is rather little about employment in the 22 book.
23 book, actually.
Okay, thank you. Yes. And there were several reasons for this emphasis on the internal stability. And one of those which Keynes emphasized was that too much debate on the sterling-dollar exchange rates and the different cost levels in US and UK at that time, because if, well, the British debate had looked at the continent, then they would have realized that the actual exchange rate there was 20-30% below the pre-war. So, going back to the old parity of the gold standard would damage British export to the continent. And he developed his ideas further, and one could say as a part, he was not taking directly part in the so-called Genoa Conference. And that was in 22?
I don't remember.
Okay. I might confuse these two things. And then he writes up after the Genoa Conference, where he brings forward these proposals in the book in 23. I think that's the correct order.
Yes,
so the Genoa Conference is in 22.
The first book of Keynes I read was The Tract as an undergraduate in 1950. Oh. So I do remember.
Yeah. Okay, his proposal there was, well, in fact, it was maybe just an afterthought, but he was thinking, why not let the exchange rate be as flexible as the rate of interest? Because, Bank of England will then take over the duty of regulating the price of gold, just as it already regulates the rate of discount. And each week, could it consider a change in the exchange rate by a half or 1% in the gold price? So why should the exchange rate be so rigid when we have a flexible rate of interest set by the monetary authority? So, it was in his mind, but nothing came out of the Geneva conference anyhow, except that it contributed to the fall of Lloyd George. And after a short interlude with a Labour government, well, the Conservatives were back in offices, and well, to the surprise of nearly everyone, with Winston Churchill as the Chancellor of Exchequer. Churchill seems to have been somewhat in doubt about the exchange rate policy. At least, well, he arranged a dinner in Downing Street number 11, where Keynes and McKenna, a former Chancellor of Exchequer for the Liberals, together with two representatives from the Treasury, two orthodox representatives from the Treasury, Niemeyer and Bradbury, were present. But Keynes failed, one can say, unfortunately. But anyway, Keynes failed to convince Churchill. Shortly after, well, the embargo on gold export was lifted, and the next step during the spring of 25 was, well, to re-establish the pre-war parity. And that was, well, a fact, not only of life, but a fact of policy. It seems that Keynes realized and accepted, because from now on, Keynes seems not really to debate the gold standard and the exchange rate policy related to that. Although, well, the negative consequences came out much in accordance with his projections, there were still high unemployment, and wages did not come down as was expected, at least so the cost level could be in parity with the Americans. And furthermore, which he also well had projected, the rate of interest was kept 1% higher than in New York to be sure that gold was not flowing out, but quite the opposite, flowing into London. His acceptance of the gold standard during at least the text which I have gone through became more and more anchored, so much that in March 31, that's after, well, the Wall Street crash and the recession has initiated, he wrote a paper for the New Statesman and Nation with the title "A Proposal for a Revenue Tariff." And everyone had up till then thought of Keynes as a free trader, at least. That made, quite a sensation. But it also demonstrated that, well, he was rather anchored in this thinking, and this is with a view to the euro situation. Few people can imagine life without a euro, but let's see what comes. Anyway, I would have rather have expected a title like from Keynes in the spring 31, "Time for Devaluation," or "Devaluation, the Only Way Forward." So it tells something about the intellectual atmosphere that no such thing was put forward. But, well, within half a year, as you know, Britain left the gold standard in September 21st, and the political debate seems to change dramatically immediately after. And Keynes was not late in making a statement on this changed situation. He wrote a paper already on the 27th of September 31, which he called The Future, or The New Future of the World, and where states there are, and this is just, well, a week after the departure from the gold standard, there are few Englishmen who do not rejoice at the breaking of our gold fetters, and we can begin to discuss realistically what policy is for the best. And he continues, shall we in Great Britain invite three quarters of the world to join with us in evolving a new currency system? So Keynes was quick in, well, taking up that time was, and tide was changing. Time was ripe for new economic thinking, also in this area. And, well, now comes a prelude, because I try to combine what I call Keynes as a doubtful neoclassical economist and as a converted macroeconomist or general theorist or whatever we should call him. He was, well, just his own from the 30s onwards. And therefore, I think it's difficult to appreciate in full depth the different suggestions for organizing exchange rate system after the First World War and after the Second World War without taking this prelude into consideration. And, this is an ongoing debate, what is the essence of general theory. And I will not go into that here. Well, that we can take during the discussion. But I just try to put emphasis on three important matters related to exchange rate systems. The outcome of my reading of the general theory, well, uncertainty cannot be, and the importance of uncertainty for understanding macroeconomic dynamics can probably not be underestimated, or overestimated, I should say here, overestimated. Well, really, it's run as a red thread throughout the entire book, as we know here. And then the second thing, and in some way I'm repeating what you said on Tuesday, you said uncertainty, the economic system as a whole, yes, is an important part of, and I very much agree, I think, without having the economy as a whole in mind, which is difficult because there are so many markets, and to keep, well, the interrelationship of so many markets in disequilibrium, or not in market-hearing equilibrium in one's mind at one time is what, pain-taking.
Liquidity preference.
Thank you. And then finally, well, how to make a proper analysis of this system as a whole. Well, usually, as we know, a general equilibrium framework is employed, but that leave out all the interesting dynamics and maladjustments in the system. So these are the three elements which I will try to draw into the understanding of how he imagined the after Second World War exchange rate system could be organized. And let me then go move on to that. This is too much reading, but for those of you who might either think that my accent is a bit strange or a bit boring, then you can read. This is taken from Skidelsky, 2005, and I think very illuminating. The point is that Keynes was asked, he did not really concentrate on the exchange rate system during the 30s. There's very little written on that. He was asked by the Treasury, where he was in some way voluntarily employed during the war, to draft a plan for the post-war international currency system. And at that time, well, gold was considered old-fashioned and in much too little or short supply. Keynes was afraid of lack of international liquidity as soon as, well, things were normalized and foreign trade would pick up. Because the experience from the gold standard was that France and US had hoarded gold and therefore drained the system for liquidity. So therefore, he was thinking in terms of setting up a kind of international bank which could create liquidity by itself. Very much as we have experienced, well, within the last 10 or 20 years, that banks can create, well, floods of liquidity. too much, one would say. And this idea of the international clearing bank, that should be set up and guaranteed by the participating member states. And all international payments had to be settled within the bank in a new international currency, the so-called banker. Keynes didn't care much about the name, call it whatever. The important thing was that liquidity, international liquidity, could be created without any commitment to gold or other constraints, but it could be increased on request of the board of governors. He has a suggestion that if there's too little international liquidity, well, we just increase the amount of bankers which this bank can issue. So that was a very flexible system. Furthermore, a deficit country could borrow and was allowed to borrow, of course, within limits, but it could borrow bankers from this clearing bank. It did not have to go, a deficit country did not have to go to one of the creditor countries and ask for liquidity. Well, at that time, well, Keynes had, of course, in mind that Britain should not go to the US to ask for more international money, because he feared of this dollar shortage. And the present situation, you don't have to go to Germany to borrow your own money. But that's not another story, but part of the story later. Keynes had been well aware of the asymmetry in the old system, that all the burden of adjustment was experienced by the deficit country. Therefore, to put some pressure on the creditor countries, he suggested that there should also be paid an interest on the creditor position. So you accumulate some financial assets, but you have to pay an interest on this accumulation as long as it's nominated in bankers. So instead of getting an interest, you have to pay an interest on this positive banker account. In this way, there would be an incentive for both parties, because the debtor countries should also pay an interest on their debt to the clearing bank. So, well, the clearing bank would get interest payment from the debtor and from the creditor. Very, very intelligent. In this way, there would be an incentive for both parties to reduce their balance of payments imbalance. He even was so radical that he suggested that a creditor position beyond the quota, there was different quotas on how many bankers one could borrow or were allowed to accumulate. On top of that, if a creditor nation went beyond the quota, it should be paid in full amount into the clearing bank, was a part of the suggestion. All this was, of course, not accepted by the Americans. That's trivial. That's trivial. But I think it demonstrated rather creative mind. And, well, at least I'm not sure if all of this became a part of the official UK proposal for Bretton Woods. Well, I think not the confiscation at top of the quota, but you have to pay an interest on the creditor position was a part of it. So this was the main suggestion to set up this international clearing bank. And then he was not as keen as the Americans on setting up this international capital control. He was not against it, but that was not the major part of his suggestion. And furthermore, he was also in favor of a change in the exchange rate, which was set originally. My reading of Keynes cannot give really a firm statement on what principles such a change could be undertaken. Let us just then. So that was his suggestion. And what came out, well, all of us know, was the Bretton Woods Agreement, which was, well, more dominated by the American thinking, which was the thinking of a creditor nation. But still, the basic principles that there should be some international liquidity organized through the IMF was still there. There should be the possibility of capital control, and then was the possibility of exchange rate changes. So we are far from the gold exchange system. We would have been even further away from that system if Keynes' system has been implemented. But the Americans was, well, quite a step in that direction, and even more than a step, more similar to what Keynes suggested than the old gold standard. So this really demonstrates how the thinking of economics and the thinking of organizing monetary system has changed from World War I to World War II. And of course, Keynes' main concern was at that time macroeconomic imbalances, especially persistent unemployment. And therefore, the balance of payments must not or should not be a constraint on the national policies of reorganizing or establishing, if not full employment, then acceptable employment. And he had, at the end, more trust in the potentials for stabilizing through discretionary actions undertaken by politicians and semi-autonomous institutions, like, for example, the Bank of England, than to leave macroeconomic adjustment to the market forces alone. That's come out clear. Well, and there's no doubt that Keynes preferred discretion to inflexible rules, but when and by whom should discretionary decisions be taken was also to Keynes a delicate matter, especially with concern to the exchange rate, because exchange rates has always been highly politicized. And as we shall see, Keynes was doubtful to what extent politicians were able to make reasonable decisions on the exchange rate, for at least two reasons. The exchange rate is a relative price between domestic and foreign money, which has an impact on the trading partners, so you cannot just do it unilaterally. And political prestige is associated with a strong currency, although it might be a strong currency, might be harmful to industry. The Bretton Woods Agreement was open, as we know, to adjustment of exchange rates, but these adjustments were usually undertaken at a much delayed initiative of governments, and therefore speculators were never taken by surprise. And governments were often the last party, we should see in practice, the last party to exercise the inevitable adjustment. And, well, the experience of the UK and the EMS, well, is just one example of this. Unfortunately, we cannot know how Keynes's clearing union would have worked in practice, because it was, as I explained, the American plans which came out. Therefore, well, we cannot say. But fortunately, the American administration, although they had this more limited plan for the currency, international currency organization, well, they supported the weak Western European countries. In other ways, the Marshall Aid was a much needed relief, well, to reduce balance of payments deficits. And there was not, as I said, this dollar shortage, because the American balance of payments went into deficit quite quickly on the capital account during the 50s and also on the current account during the 60s. And that created, well, some distrust in the convertibility of the dollar into gold, and that was challenged. And then suddenly, by a stroke, well, Nixon just lifted the fixed exchange rate between dollar and gold on the 15th of August, 71. That would, well, or most of our thought at that time, be a definitive goodbye to, well, any link between currency and gold. And now, well, we are heading towards the actual European situation. Well, I will not go through, well, the difficulties which Europe had in the period from giving, when Nixon gave up the Bretton Woods Agreement and the fixed rate to gold, and the organization of the monetary union in Europe, because, well, what time do I? 10 minutes is left?
Yes,
around that. So, no doubt that, well, Europe has, with regard to exchange rate, been in turmoil at least since the breaking up of the Bretton Woods and until the monetary union was established in 1999. And then, well, a fixed exchange rate system, more fixed than the gold standard, was established with the euro and the monetary union. And from a, well, superficial point of view, one could say that at least in the euro countries, there have been no exchange rate turmoil since then. But that does not mean that macroeconomic imbalances has gone, but it has, well, drifted from one market to other markets, it seems to be the case. And, the argument was that one common currency would protect smaller national money from speculative attacks, especially if capital control is ruled out. But this was a rather naive thinking, because you can speculate in other things than, the exchange rate. And then one should have realized from, the experience or bad experience of the gold standard that, if cost level in traded good industries are not developing in parallel, you ask for difficulties. Then, of course, the imbalance moved from the exchange market to the real goods markets. And that could have devastating social consequences. We have all the evidences from the 30s. And in some way, it's revealing to look at the numbers. But let me just put just as a, just in bracket, couldn't one have known that in advance? Yes, one could, if one has read Keynes, A. And B, there was a number of post-Keynesian economists who said, what do we know about this working of the monetary system? And I can say from my part, I joined the debate of the Danish referendum on, because maybe Denmark is not so much on the radar screen, but anyway, we have our own currency, and we have had a referendum joining the euro or not. There was a slight majority against that. Sweden had a referendum as well. They were at a larger majority against joining the euro. And in the UK, it might come, the referendum. Mm. I don't know. But anyway, here, just, I think, it is important. As Keynes said, we should be realistic about macroeconomics. And to be realistic about macroeconomics is just to see that unemployment has never been higher in Europe since the Second World War than it is today, and it is higher in the EMU countries than in the floating or own currency countries that you can see from this. Does it go through? Yes, it does go through. It's from the year 2000 and then to year 2013. And we have the euro countries with the highest unemployment, and then the entire EU with a somewhat lower, which means that those without a euro has a significantly lower unemployment rate. I can say for, I think, all countries except the Baltic states, which are special cases. And here, one can see the development in unemployment from the early 70s, 2 million unemployed in the Eurozone, and until today, where there is more than 17 million unemployed. And the trend, is upward. And then I've just been wondering, why is it on this move upward? And, there are many explanations, but I find it strikingly, and this has not that much to do with the euro as such. I think it is more to say about macroeconomic imbalance. Here we see the share of real investment in GDP in Europe for the same period, early 70s, or it goes back to the 60s, but the interesting part is from the early 70s and then up till today. And here you see a falling trend. So, there are many explanations. And, the euro is only a part that it seems to have made a bad situation worse because of these rigidities, as we know. And, well, rigidities. The other part, which we could have learned from reading Keynes, is that cost and cost levels have to move in tandem. And I've just figured out here, Germany, that's the purple one, and the relative unit labor cost has fallen by 20% during the EMU period, which means that it has become, compared with its trading partners, become 20% more cheap to produce German goods. Whereas the southern European countries, and there you see, well, Spain, Italy, and Greece, until the year 2008, will have moved up by 20%, which means that there, at that time, was a gap of 40% in competitiveness within a monetary union. And that, of course, is asking for troubles. And what did they get? Troubles. Here we have the balance of payments in the beginning of the EMU period, 1999, the year 2008, which is really, well, the worst situation at all. And look at Greece. Well, Greece is always mentioned, but then look at Spain or Portugal, running a balance of payments deficit of 10% of GDP on your current accounts. That would have been absolutely impossible if they had had their own currency. And financial markets had understood that, an EMU, a common currency, does not mean the same risk on bonds and borrowing. So one is wondering why, at least as a part of the convergence criteria, there was no obligation of limiting the current account deficit for some countries. And here, if I had a pointer, I would point. Yes, Germany, here. Well, Germany, well, you say 6-7% of GDP, but multiply that on their GDP. That adds up at least to the sum of Portugal, Greece, and Spain, at least, and even more.
Like China and the world.
Yeah, in fact, well, the current account surplus of Germany is larger in nominal terms than China, the Chinese. And there's no mechanism to reduce that. And living within, and here one should look at the European economy as a whole, because if there is a surplus, there has to be a deficit somewhere. That's, well, undisputable. And as you can see, that the Eurozone as an entity, partly due to the flexible or floating euro rate, has more or less balance on the current account. So it means that surpluses and deficit has to cancel out inside the monetary union. For sure, as long as the external exchange rate is not manipulated, European Central Bank could start a procedure like Bank of Japan to devaluate the currency and by that create a surplus for the entire area. But that isn't easy because an exchange rate, as I said, is a dual rate. There could be someone objecting to that, the Americans, for example. So this is, well, where we are right now, and things has, to be honest, changed somewhat in Spain. If we take this year, 2013, well, there will be a surplus on the Spanish current account, partly because they have become more competitive, as you can see here. But the improvement of Spain is partly due to these rather impressive, well, internal devaluation, one should say, and furthermore to the deep recession.
Mm.
So it is this combination. But Germany, well, they have not renounced on their competitive position, at least not yet. Now we can see what comes out of the negotiations for the for the new government in Germany and a minimum wage. But I think this I should demonstrate also how unevenly unemployment is distributed. And here, well, this is the EU countries and Spain, Greece, unemployment 26%. No one, for sure not I, would ever have imagined 5 years ago that anything like that could happen in peacetime or in welfare Europe or in whatever Europe. And then, well, there's this falling. But the point is how uneven. Here we have Austria, Germany, and maybe to the interest of the audience, the UK here, doing surprisingly well, taking your very low growth into consideration. But that I'm not a specialist. Denmark is here, Sweden there. So and you will see that the major part of those with their own currency, except from Baltikum, has below average unemployment. So probably I should stop here. This is a list of literature, and we could also debate what to do and what will come out. I think there is a lot of good inspiration from the reading of Keynes. Of course, more inspiration from the post-World War II writing than from the gold standard. But I think the gold standard is the most relevant because Europe is crossified, as it is said, crossified to gold for the time being, or to the euro. So thank you for your patience.
Thank you, yes. Jeff, would you like to comment?
Well, yes, thank you very much, and thank you very much for your welcome, which I really appreciate. I am at a slight disadvantage because the paper that I read applied lessons from the economic consequences of the peace to what's happening in Europe, so my comments are directed towards that. However, when we're talking about what to do and the role of post-Keynesian and so on, I would like to point out that we outnumber by nearly 3-1 the number of people who met to plan the Russian Revolution. So that's an optimistic optimistic start.
Okay.
It was, especially when we wait for quality. But I will make a number of points. I've very much enjoyed both papers.
Thank you.
I know, of course, Jasper is one of the great and the good in preaching common sense and humane values, and it's great to be able to comment on him. But let me just point out that the model which underlay the economic consequences of the peace, and also Keynes in the transfer problem, and even in the treatise, was not the economics of Keynes as we understand it now, because the general theory, of course, was written, was published in 36. And one of the interesting things which I would like to mention, even though it's not in the present paper, is that a splendid Frenchman called Etienne Mantoux, the son of Paul Mantoux, the economic historian, was killed in the last week of the European War, fighting for France, wrote a book called The Economic Consequences of Mr. Keynes. That was the subtitle. The title was The Carthaginian Peace. And what he did was to take the economics of the general theory and apply it as a critique of the analysis of the economic consequences of the peace, and also the other models of Keynes to which you referred in your paper, which came out of Keynes having Marshall as his teacher and implicitly assumed, at least in the long term, full employment. And therefore this magnified the reparations problem, which was what Keynes was discussing in the economic consequences of the peace, because it was a matter of changing a fully employed economy so that you got an export surplus to meet the reparations and the transfer problem. But as Etienne Mantoux pointed out, that if you started off from a position of heavy unemployment, which indeed you did, then there was a possibility of a free lunch as far as the economics, not the politics, was concerned, because you could raise the exports that you needed in order to meet the transfer problem, but you could do it by putting back to work unemployed people and underemployed capital goods, your existing capital stock, and that made the orders of magnitude of the problem, not politically but economically, very different. And I always thought one of the tragedies of the post-war period was that both Keynes and Mantoux were not there, because I think that Keynes and Mantoux would have come to an agreement, and they would have given much more wise advice on what to do about the post-war problems in the light of their debate. So that's the first point I want to make. This ties in to the debate associated, which is, I think, connected with what you're talking about, is the first oil price shock. When that occurred, there was a very, very fine article published by Marcus Miller in the AER, where he compared how a Keynesian would analyse it and what they would do about it, and how a Friedmanite would do it. And he said, as far as the Keynesian was concerned, the problem was to maintain employment but to cut real income, because there'd been a cut in real income because of oil was so much dearer, and yet it was a necessary input. And that sacrifice needed to be spread equitably amongst the whole community. Whereas a Friedmanite would say, no, whether you say it or not, but it was implied in their model that there would have to be a change in the structure of a fully employed economy and in relative prices as a result. And I always thought that was one of the best articles that Marcus ever wrote, and was wonderful for teaching, but wonderful for understanding what to do about it. As you rightly pointed out, Keynes always wanted the creditors as well as the debtors to behave responsibly, and tried to devise means, incentives, carrots and sticks to make them do so. But of course, as you said, the Americans wouldn't accept it, and they didn't win out, and they won out at Bretton Woods. So in effect, they recreated the gold standard, a sort of modified form of the gold standard. And that had a detrimental effect after a while, because there was a built-in contractionary bias into the workings of the European and ultimately the world economy, which has disastrous consequences, which we see magnified now in these terrible figures for unemployment, and that's not possible to be continued. It will lead to increasing social unrest and possibly the collapse of the European economy as we know, which Keynes was trying to preserve in the economic consequences of the peace, to re-establish a viable European economy by his suggestions. But what post-Keynesians very importantly, I think, have added to the argument is the idea that we are not equilibrating mechanisms. On the whole, we are mechanisms of cumulative causation. Now, Keynes described that in the economic consequences of the peace, but his underlying theory was still an equilibrating mechanism associated with Say's law and so on, whereas I think the post-Keynesians, one of their greatest contributions, to say, no, look, if important markets and important systems are subject to cumulative causation, you're going to either go upwards into a virtuous movement or down into a vile one. And you have to think, when you're policy making, you've got to take that into account to try and bring those divergences to an end.
Yeah.
And that is a problem. Finally, you mentioned the problem of people worrying about deficits and debt to income ratios, particularly in this paper here. But what has been forgotten, I think, in the debate, and I think it's very important, is that if you have a growing economy or growing economies, then an article by F.C. Domer in the late 40s or early 50s on how you can run continuous deficits, not expanding ones, but continuous deficits without the debt-to-income ratio blowing out, because that is a byproduct of growth. Now, that has been recognised by people like Martin Wolf and Krugman in the current debate, but it has not generally been accepted because we've imposed the wrong criteria on what fiscal policy should do. Balanced budgets, preferably surpluses, come what may, regardless of, as you point out in your paper, of what the situation in the private sector is. But that's the wrong criteria. And if we went back to thinking about the distinction between internal and external balance, external debt, very important,
because
internal debt is a transfer between those who hold the debt and those who don't.
Yeah.
And you may not like the equity consequences of that, but you can tackle that through your tax system.
Within your own borders.
Yes, but external debt does require a real burden,
yeah,
which you may be willing to accept if the borrowing is used in such a way that your growth rates are such that you can supply the extra exports needed to service the debt and its repayment and still be better off than you otherwise would have been.
Yeah.
That has been lost sight of, I think, in the discussion of fiscal and monetary policy. But the other thing is, which comes out from your concentration very properly on the difference in cost levels and therefore the ability to overcome a deficit or to get rid of a surplus, is the need to establish within, if we're going to have proper levels of employment as opposed to these terrible levels of unemployment, we have to have, fitting into the needs of the societies concerned, we have to have forms of permanent incomes policies so that money incomes change in a way which is consistent with us getting back to balance at full employment or high levels of employment in each individual country, not to run into the problem which Kaletsky so rightly perceived, that if you have sustained full employment after a while, you're going to get accelerating inflation associated with the move from of economic, political, and social power from capital to labour. His famous 43 paper, which I've bored you stiff over the years with returning to, but I will bore you stiff again because it is such a perceptive paper, as applicable now as when he wrote it in 1943. So I think that when we think about what are we going to do about what's happening, we must remember that we live in a world of cumulative causation processes and not strongly equilibrating ones. We must remember that not only should we be one club people, i.e. the interest rate, we need fiscal policy as well, but we also need income, some form of permanent incomes policy if we're ever going to get out of the mess that we're in. Now, that's utopian because people remember incomes policy, and even when they've been successfully applied, like they were for quite a long time in Australia, we've now just got rid of the institutions which made that possible. Nevertheless, we have to keep plugging away at that. Otherwise, we're never going to solve the problems that that we're in. And, well, I don't care whether the euro breaks up or not particularly. I think the one good thing, one of the few good things that Gordon Brown did was to keep us out out of joining the euro. But if we are going to have some smaller form of currency union, we have to keep all these things in mind. Yeah, yeah. And I think that your paper has drawn our attention to that, and people of goodwill have got to keep plugging away at, look, you've got the wrong criteria, you've got all the wrong advice, you're fooling people, you're imposing unnecessary hardships, you're encouraging the rise of a modern form of fascism and Nazism around Europe. There's a chance of blowing the whole thing up, and it's unnecessary because there are alternative ways.
Yeah.
There is another way.
It's just money.
It's just money, that's true. And as Groucho Marx said, the trouble with happiness is it can't buy money. those are my feelings on both your paper today and the one I actually read, because as I don't do email, I hadn't printed off the other one, but I hope my remarks are at least tangentially relevant to what you had to say, and I really enjoyed it. And I think that Jasper is one of the good people of Europe, and there are not many left.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.